Yeah,
Now,
or
the difference between that and these arguments based on the structure of reality
which
is
is the
that,
major.
as far as I understand, what he talks about here, the structure of reality is not not as basic as these quasi-logical arguments, but rather a structure of more cultural reality, like things that we have already accepted as real. And that, for example, there's a connection between a person's actions and their character. And that's not in all cultures the case, because there's such an idea as being possessed by demons or different spirits at different times, right? So that connection between a person and their actions is not true in all cultures, but it's true in Western culture.
Right.
The idea
right.
of ethos, right?
Right.
And
right. Proman and Obrecht, I take it, call it coexistence.
Right, exactly. As soon as elements of reality are associated with each other in a recognized connection, it is possible to use this connection as the basis for an argument, which allows us to pass from what is accepted to what we wish to have accepted. And that's the basic structure of arguments based on the structure of reality.
That's right. And here I just want to emphasize that we are talking about the reality that we are living in.
Right.
That's right. There is a physical reality of which we know at least attributes through our limited mind and senses, but you know, this is the reality that we inhabit. And so for us, the co-reality is the coexistence is the reality we live in, you know, and it may parallel or not parallel the physical reality. So when you talk about the structure of reality, it's rhetorical, but rhetoric embraces even science. And
right.
So
and it's kind of important to point out, right? These structures may only be natural in the sense that a path made through a field is natural. Right, but because it is natural in the sense that now there's a path there, but it wasn't there before, right? But we've made that now. We made that neural pathway in our brain, and so now that exists. And so in the same way that the cultural reality becomes reality, accepted reality, and so because of that, you can use it to make arguments.
Yes.
And he talks about liaisons of coexistence and liaisons of succession, right? Where coexistence is kind of where something is, other things cluster around it. And liaisons of succession is that where something happens, something else follows. The liaisons of succession, for example, such as cause, effect, fact, and consequence.
Yeah.
One of the ones he talked about there, which I have to say, Americans are addicted to, is the pragmatic argument, especially when it comes to business, right? Someone is a success or a failure in sports or in business, that says something about the innate quality of the person.
Yeah.
Right? The argument is that you evaluate a fact by its consequences. So, oh, well, because the economy succeeded during this presidency, the president must be a great president on economics, right? Because Trump is still a billionaire despite his old many failures, he must be a great businessman.
I'm not even gonna comment.
This
on
person
that.
Won but the Super Bowl, true. And so because of that, they're the greatest sportsman ever, right? Instead of saying that, you know, serendipity has a role to play here, so many other factors go into, you know, that, for example, starting off as a millionaire is a great way to become a billionaire, you know.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because in classical rhetorical terminology, a lot of these are antecedent consequent arguments, as opposed to causal. And you know, as David Hume, for instance, pointed out, we only see effects, so we don't see causes. We don't see the law of causality. We don't see the cause of the cause laws of cause operating. And so we see one thing following another, and we can presuppose, oh, there's some causal relation here, physical causal relation. And they very well might not be. It might just be one thing following another. But in human culture, which is the coexistent, you know, in human reality, they are causal. That sense. I mean,
that's the way we perceive them. Yeah,
that's the way we perceive them.
So
yeah,
Perlman says that the pragmatic argument, which seems to reduce the value of a cause to that of its consequences, gives the impression that all values are of the same order.
Right.
It is thus that the truth of an idea can, in pragmatism, only be judged by its effects. And the failure of an enterprise or life, likewise, serving as a criterion of its irrationality or inauthenticity. I hate the historians that write that the Byzantine Empire was doomed to failure, for example. And that's such a... It started out as a justification for the Crusades that destroyed Byzantium, right? Saying that, well, it was such a corrupt state anyway, and it was just, you know, just waiting for someone to take it over, essentially. And it just ignores the vitality and the strength of that tradition and all the things that they withstood that lesser empires would have faded away from, right? So this kind of judgment of history also, this idea that history is linear somehow, right? That's right side of history. All these things are the pragmatic argument. And I have to say, I feel like American culture has a oversized naive view of the and buy-in of the pragmatic argument.
It's true, and it extends, just to be a little more inclusive. I mean, it extends to the way we view work,
You make your own success.
Right, the way we view poverty and the poor.
The way you view disabilities, you know.
Disabilities,
I didn't let my illness, I didn't let my circumstances dictate for me. I created my own future. It's like, some people aren't able to do that.
Exactly. And it's amazing to see what happens after that. Not only laws, but actions by physical people, whether it's running a car into their truck into them or shooting them or spitting on them because they can't get up off the ground by themselves. I mean, it's shocking. It's just shocking how powerful.
Its worst, its might is right, right? You're able to will to power. You're able to create your own world or you're not. And if you're not, then you don't have the right to live. At its absurd lengths, meritocracy becomes... Power is might is right. It's only we're talking about intellectual power or other kinds of power, right?
Build the power and the Ubermensch, right?
The ones
I'm
who
I'm not going to blame here.
Right. Then there's the arguments of the means and end, right? That means only have a relative value because they depend on the value according to the end, right? Yes. So the ends justify the means argument. That's another one of that.
That's right. And I've written about when the ends justify the means and the ends are technological ends.
Right.
They become the values of the technology, which is
the
speed, production.
Uninhibited development of AI for its own sake.
Yes. Right. Yes. The so-called technological imperative, but you see it operating everywhere. So AI
consummation is called with Kenneth Burke. Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Once we start killing people, well, let's do it efficiently with more technology, efficient, quicker, and with more productivity, more results. Those are technological values that are inherent in technology.
I mean, we use some of these. Like, I'm sorry I yelled at you, but I'm trying to stop you from getting hit by the car. You know, that's... It's okay. Yeah. I don't usually act like this, but this was an extreme situation. So in order to save your life, the ends that justified that means, I would usually not pull you like that, but I'm saving your life.
They don't have to be negative, just as expediency can be used for good.
Right.
Good ends. Yes. So absolutely.
And then, then there's the argument of waste, right? Is that a certain... existence of an effective means allows us to realize a desire and gives the desire stability sufficient to transform it into an end. To avoid wasting effort in attaining a certain end, a person will continue a project until it is completed. The action which under the circumstances can attain its full bearing and thus should not be considered a waste will thereby gain in value, and this militates in favor of it being done. Right? We talk about Jurassic Park, right? They were so busy thinking whether or not they could. They never stopped to think whether or not they should.
That's right.
We can do this thing. We can gene edit humans. We can change the genetic code of humans. We can make designer babies, you know, the ability to do something and something, an effective means by itself militates for a certain end.
Right. Yeah, and it's funny the way it excludes other kinds of considerations and ethics. So, for instance, the development of AI, you know, one of the leading scientists in that has resigned from Google and is now questioning the ethics of what he's done.
Right.
I can't remember his name, but you know, you also have this argument of waste operating in a lot of different ways. I've lost my train of thought. Sorry.
So there's in some ways it's a very aesthetic argument, which is what Kenneth Burke says, right? That being able to do something in itself is that you can do something and follow something to a certain extent. You recognize that as a researcher, there's an inherent drive there to follow something to its uttermost conclusion. As a creative artist, you know, you want to finish a song, you want to finish a poem, you don't want to have it unfinished there in your book. You want to finish it, right? And this drive for completion to follow something, this kind of, it's a very inherent aesthetic delight in our nature, I believe.
It is. I kind of remember Burke talking about it in relation to a circle.
Yeah.
Or they used to use it this way, that if you leave the circle unfinished, there'll be this human. Where was that? Form and in Kenneth Burke, that discussion of form. Maybe it's literary form, but you want to finish. It's like a motive. You want the completion.
And then there's an argument of direction that can be used to kind of stop that, where you can resist this by saying, foreseeing or anticipating future developments, you oppose the first step, fearing that it will lead to a slippery slope that will not allow stopping, and in the end it will lead to total capitulation. Right. So you try to see the beginning or the end from the beginning in some ways. And on the other hand, you have the argument of infinite development, right? That's, again, something that's very often that you find a lot in science, where you consider each realization in the given field as only a stage in an infinite progression, usually towards some never-ending quest for some utopia. The Shape of Things to Come by H.G. Wells, he talked about the Second World War that he predicted being a necessary step towards a future scientific utopia. And then he takes this into an attitude where he says, is there to be no rest? And the other one answers, rest enough for the individual, perhaps, in The Shape of Things to Come. But too much and too soon, we call it death. But for man, no rest and no ending. He must go on, conquest beyond conquest. First this little planet with its whims and ways, then all the laws of mind and matter that restrain it, and then all the planets that are about it, and at last out across the immensity of the stars. And when he has conquered all the deeps of space and all the mysteries of time, still he will be beginning.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. That's the argument of the infinite development, right? Humans controlling nature to its uttermost conclusion.
Yeah, good luck with getting to the edge of the universe, which is always expanding.
Right.
Yeah, no, this is a very powerful argument, and it is used in science. And it's like, well, we have the ability to edit genes. We got to go for it. And, you know, and to do so would be a waste of all everything that's preceded. Now it has good qualities, and it has potentially negative qualities. So I'm talking about bioengineering. I'm talking about, you know, the development of robotics and
the thing is, like, as Kenneth Burke says, the privileging of A implies the negligence of B, right? So you privilege the future on the expense of the present, potentially, right?
Right.
And so,
you know, one of the things about Burke here that's relevant, it goes back to the causality issue, is that Burke was very much against seeing things mechanically, like a cause effect. You know, much, much more interested in looking at human motivation and motives as the cause of things, and not some mechanical, scientific, science, science, what does he call it? Not scientific, but
scientistic
view of things. Thank
yes.
you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, I think that motivates a lot of his work, you know, to reveal human motivation rather than some mechanistic, under which, by the way, we lose free will. And I mean, his reading of Spinoza in The Grammar of Rhetoric is fascinating because, you know, he's working his way through, and in the end, he's like, it's sort of like God in the Jewish mystical tradition. God creates space in which creation can be created. Very much like, I know we stream now, but when we used to make CDs, you have to create the room to make sound on the CD before you can put anything on. The CD is nothing. It's an absolute blank, just like prior to the universe. You create the space in which things can be created and happen. It's fascinating stuff. Yeah.
And so the... I think we can only finish the this part here, and I think we have to plan for a second discussion because I have to go soon, and we're not close to finishing yet. But I will say the next one is, so all of these are the liaisons of succession. All of these are cause effect relationships in different ways, and then they are the liaisons of coexistence, and those ones, for example, are the ones that we recognize as ethos, right? The relationship, the connection between an act and the person that does this act, right? That there's a connection there between those things. It's not you can't necessarily say the act completely flows out from the person's character, because the act itself also influences the character. So there's kind of a cyclical relationship there. And so it's not a liaison of succession, because it's not as clear as that, but it is one of coexistence. There's a connection between, in our culture at least, between a person and the acts the person does.
Right.
We don't have the same idea of spirits overcoming a person in one moment to the next in the same way.
Right.
And so, and that's an argument of coexistence. And arguments from authority are based on this, right? That. That in the absence of demonstrable proof, we have to say, okay, well, but who has the greatest authority here? Competence, tradition, antiquity, universality, right? The different strategies or different criteria for different cultures. But arguments from authority. As Mother Teresa said, if you judge people, you have no time to love them, right? We should be so full of Christ's love that we would not have a mind or time to judge people because of their weaknesses. And that's an argument from authority. We should listen to Mother Teresa because she knows about love.
It's interesting. Can I ask you a question here? It's interesting that Perlman and Ulbricht Dietecker should classify this under arguments based on the structure of reality as opposed to, say, quasi-logical arguments. Mm-hmm. And I think they're recognizing the role of embodied beings as physical entities mm-hmm. in the world that are like physical things that have coexistence, you know, as you mentioned, the liaison between the, you know, succession and the liaison of coexistence.
Mm-hmm.
I just answered my own question.
Mm-hmm. I think so. And then the last one is kind of the double hierarchies. Again, another liaison of coexistence. So the relationship between two terms in one hierarchy are judged by another hierarchy behind it, right? So we often talk about there being a constitution behind the constitution, or the structure of divine or moral law that directs the validity of common law. Many things in our language and our societies depend on a second hierarchy to give it meaning and legitimacy. So there's the sense of just a basic argument, unjust law is no law at all, right?
Right.
So
right.
The relationship between something being justice, divine justice and divine law dictates earthly justice and earthly law. And if the earthly law does not conform to divine law, then it isn't actually a law that should be something that binds the actions of moral people.
Right. What's interesting about this, and maybe a good place to stop discussion for now, is that in especially, I think it's in the New Rhetoric at the end, you kind of have a discussion of the removal of the divine, you know, some questioning of whether God is behind all this or not, which is a very Jewish perspective on God. Let's argue about him. Because there is a Jewish feminine dimension of God as well, and Jewish mysticism, but the fact that it doesn't lose any power because of the fact that we can't prove the divine, or the divine may not exist, that in fact it's based on reasonableness, on ultimately on persuasion and rhetoric. And Agaben, who I mentioned before, has a book, The Archaeology of the Oath, where he argues and I think proves that language can have this power to bind one to one's oath without having necessarily a deity behind it, and hence the oath, whether it's sworn to God or not. It seems to me to be relevant. This idea of the double hierarchy is really, really interesting, and related. And I just wanted to point that out, since you had mentioned the divine in the coexistence. Mm-hmm. You know what the New Rhetoric ultimately does is take away or eliminate the need for the divine, and in order to still arrive at reasonable, if uncertain, and uncertain conclusions.
It's essentially, like, it takes away the need for example, a scientific basis for everything that we reason ourselves away to these things, and it's not a foundation that's completely unshakable, but it's better than nothing. And these are choices we make, these choices of values and preference, and are an effect of what we arrive at together as a society, I guess.
Right. The notion of consensus and community.